Is Literature a Way of Knowing? The third talk at Gutenberg College's 2012 Summer Institute, What the Bleep Can We Know?, was presented by Tim McIntosh on July 13, 2012. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Tim would like to acknowledge that the seed for this talk comes from an essay by Alistair MacIntyre titled Epistemological Crises, Dramatic Narratives, and the Philosophy of Science. Also, during this talk, Tim mistakenly refers to Hamlet's uncle, Claudius, as Laertes. For this, he requests forgiveness from you and the memory of William Shakespeare.
I'm not going to rely very highly on the Sayers reading during this talk, but Margaret yesterday evening, is Margaret here still? Margaret yesterday asked Casey about kind of the role and use of reason in pursuing truth and talking about what Casey was talking about. And I wanted to, the Dorothy Sayers essay weighs in, I think, on why Casey wanted to say, yeah, reason is obviously something really, in pursuing the truth, it's we got to rely on reason. But there's one way to look at reason in which I think Casey would probably say, yeah, but that way of understanding reason is too restrictive. So I'm just going to draw one little distinction, and then I'm going to go on with my talk, which is not going to have very much to do with this. So if you get in the essay, Sayers is complaining that scientists have this view of language which is just really constricting, right? They want to have fixed meanings for words, and they want those words to not change, drift, shake, or do anything, which is what language just does. That's what language does. Changing, it's moving. And so she's kind of recommending that there is a proper use of poetic language. But I just want to draw this little distinction when we talk about reason, and it's this. So this is just a three-minute lesson in Aristotle. Aristotle, the father of logic, says basically there's two types of reasoning, analytic reasoning and dialectical reasoning. It says analytic reasoning has certain goals and certain uses of language, and those uses of language are strict. Words have particular predefined meanings, like mammal. Mammal has a really specific meaning, and it's locked, right? Whereas dialectical reasoning's domain is not merely science, but it's kind of everyday speech. It's courtroom speech. It's water cooler speech. It's conversations with our friends about sports and knitting. Aristotle says that the goal of analytic reasoning, because you have fixed meanings for words, is the goal of analytic reasoning is you get to the bottom of a chain of analytic reasoning, and if your premises are true, you've got a proof, right? If mammal means this, okay, so here's an example. If, let's put up a simple syllogism like all mammals are warm-blooded, that's our first premise. Second premise is a giraffe is a mammal, then what's the conclusion? A giraffe is warm-blooded. Right? Is there any other way, if those words mean what we understand them to mean, is there any other, is it proof? Are we sure that giraffes are warm-blooded? The answer is yes. Most of the reasoning, though, that we do in everyday, like I was saying, in everyday speech, talking with our friends, if we could call the court, is dialectical reasoning, because we're messing with words that oftentimes don't have really strict, confined meanings. They're just a little bit more malleable. So the way in which that sort of reasoning works is reliant on logic, but it doesn't yield the same surety that analytic reasoning yields. Does that make sense? It yields probabilities. It seems more probable that the man holding the bloody knife in his hand when the police burst in and found the dead body at his feet, it seems most probable that he is guilty of the murder. Is it absolutely sure? No, but it seems probable. So he's convicted. So I hope that's a little bit helpful and kind of explain. I don't want to speak for you, Casey, but I wonder if that's part of the reason that Casey was like, Yes, but I want to be real clear about what I mean about reason. I don't mean this kind of scientific, constricting use of meaning. Okay. Okay, on with a talk. So my talk is on literary arts and knowing. And I'm one of the literature guys at Gutenberg, so I really like literature, but even when I heard that, literary arts and knowing, I thought, boy, when I think of literature and knowing, those two things to me don't just naturally go together the way that when I think science and knowing, I just automatically think science and knowing, those two things go together. Or when I think philosophy and knowing, philosophy is all about inquiring how we know things. So those two things seem to go together, but maybe you thought literature and knowing, well, literature is sort of the stuff of beach reading, and it's the novel that I read by lamplight before I go to bed, and it's not really about knowing so much. It's about maybe seeing the world in a slightly different way and passing the time, but it's not really about knowing. So I am going to make the case for narrative in particular as a core, essential, fundamental way in which we understand everyday life, and we use it with such frequency, with such speed, with such oftentimes precision that we hardly even notice that we're doing it. So that's what I'm up to. First, let me say this is a conference called What the Bleep Do We Can We Know, and the reason we're having the conference is because we sense that something is up with the way that we know. We sense that something's not quite working. We sense that there's some sort of epistemological crisis going on. And part of the reason we're having the conference is we're trying to get a grip on what the nature of that crisis of knowing is, what the causes of it are, and how we might be able to get out of that in a way that's truthful. Part of the reasons I think the crisis have erupted is I think the internet is a big reason for the crisis. We have so much data at our fingertips, and we have so many voices saying what that data means that it's hard to know who to trust. I think part of another big reason why we're in the middle of a crisis is that after World War I, the Western world sort of began to turn its back on about 16 years of shared cultural value. The two cities that produced that value, these two cities more than any other, were Athens and Jerusalem. Let me give you a brief description of what I mean by what those cities provided to us. Athens, so think Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, provided this hope that truth can be discovered through individual rational inquiry. Jerusalem provided the hope that truth is delivered through the insights of God's revelation. Athens provided cognition, philosophy, and science. Jerusalem emphasized personal spiritual holiness, purity of the soul. Those two cities and the values of those two cities have forever been intertwined together since basically the birth and death and resurrection of Christ. After World War I, people began to become very, very suspicious that those are really the values that we need to be holding and practicing anymore. So I think that we have kind of lost this shared sense of value. I'm not saying that people stopped being Christians en masse. That's not the claim that I'm making. I'm just saying that the general overall conversation of our society tended to not esteem Athens and Jerusalem the way they had for a long time. Okay. That's part of the reason that I think that we're enduring the crisis. So I am making the argument that understanding and telling truthful and intelligible narratives is not only fundamental to the way that we navigate everyday life, but it is a necessary and vital component to getting out of the crisis that we're in. I'm going to tell you first about how we use narrative, and I'm going to give you an example that happened to me about 2 weeks ago. And I'm going to show you, hopefully, how I constructed a story that made sense of a bizarre event. So I go to Kiva. Have you guys ever been to Kiva, the grocery store near the library? I'm at Kiva, and I was telling Jack about this yesterday. I walk in and I say, hey, I need some boxes. I'm moving a bunch of stuff. And the guy said, yeah, they're over there in the window. So I'm over there in the window and I've got my arms full of these cardboard boxes, and a woman that I've never seen before, she's maybe 50 years old, she's got a friend with her, walks up to me and she says, Panja is going to call you back. And I've never seen this person before. And so I'm sort of frozen. I don't know quite what to do. And so I think maybe I've misunderstood her. And I say, excuse me? And she says the exact same thing. Panja is going to call you back. So here's what I did. I did the same thing I think that you would do in this situation. My mind immediately, almost instinctively, starts coming up with explanatory stories of what happened before this moment. So here are some of the possible explanatory narratives. One possible explanatory narrative, this is not one that I thought of, is that this woman is a spy for the Taliban, and she thinks that I'm a double agent, and the code word to indicate that she is a spy for the Taliban is Panja is going to call you back. Another possible narrative interpretation is that this woman has just arrived from her psychologist, and her psychologist, in trying to help her get over her shyness problem, has said, you need to just walk up to a stranger and just say any old thing. Like what? Like, Panja will call you back. Just try it. Okay, so that's a possible narrative interpretation. Neither one of those occurred to me. Here are the three that did occur to me. This woman thinks that she knows me, and she has an acquaintance named Panja or a friend named Panja who is going to call me, okay? But, I mean, all this is happening really quick. I think, no, that's probably not the case, because I'm not good with names, but I am good with faces, and I am sure I've never seen this woman before. I'm really confident I've never seen this woman before. So I quickly crossed that one off my list. The next narrative interpretation that I come up with is that Panja knows me, and she is relating a message to Panja, but that wouldn't make any sense, because how would this woman know that I know Panja without ever having seen me before? So I cross that one off the list, and then I arrive at the one that seems most plausible to me. I'm sorry, ma'am. I don't work at Kiva, right? And she says, oh, I'm sorry, and she wanders off and finds someone who works for Kiva. So pay attention to what happened. I mean, because this happened to you sometime this week, not this exact story, but something like this happened. And you posed a little narrative to yourself that possibly explained the strange event that happened in your life. I came up with a short narrative that explained all of the known facts of the case. I'm in Kiva. I am holding cardboard boxes. I've never seen this woman. She just said Panja is going to call you back. There are a variety of other facts that I know. And I threw, in essence, a net over all of those facts. I tried on a shirt that accounted for all those facts, and the shirt that seemed to fit the best was, she thinks that I work at Kiva, and I don't work at Kiva. And that does seem to be what the solution to the case is. Is it absolutely proof positive that my narrative account of what had happened before then is absolutely the case? No, it's not absolutely the case, but it seems highly probable. Okay. I think that little thing that happened to me was a mini epistemic crisis, okay? It caused me to ask not just things like, I need a little more information here, but it caused me to wonder who I was in relation to this woman. Who does she think that I am, right? So my role with regards to her was very confusing. I didn't know how to act, meaning, as soon as I could understand what the misunderstanding was, I would know the question to ask to clear up the misunderstanding. But I don't know the nature of the misunderstanding. I don't know what she thinks. So I don't know how to act. I don't know what question to ask, right? So this is the nature of a crisis, of a big crisis of knowing. It's not just that, like, a lack of, there's not just a lack of information. There's a lack, you don't know who you are when you have these little epistemic crises. You don't know what your role is with regards to the other person or the situation that you're in. And you don't quite know how to act in the situation with regards to the other person, right? So, I'm going to now talk about two characters that both faced huge epistemic crises. Not Kiva epistemic crises, but massive epistemic crises. And the first one I'm going to talk about is Hamlet, is Shakespeare's Hamlet. And the second one that I'm going to talk about is René Descartes. And what I'm going to propose to you is that Hamlet solves his epistemic crisis in a way that succeeds. And I'm going to propose to you that Descartes poses an epistemic solution that fails. And I'm going to talk about the difference. And I think the primary difference is that Hamlet poses a narrative story that encompasses the problem and explains the problem, and Descartes does not. So I'm giving away, that's the surprise. That's the answer. Okay. So I guess he's a little bit unsuccessful in that regard. Hamlet does die. Does anybody not know that Hamlet dies? I'm waiting to see the movie. I am curious. Raise your hand if you feel like you know generally the outline of the story of Hamlet. You've seen the play recently. Okay. I'm going to give a cursory recounting then, just so we're all on the same page. First, let me describe this. What's the nature of Hamlet's crisis? The nature of Hamlet's crisis is this. When the story starts, Hamlet is in mourning. Hamlet has lost his father, the good king. It's not a crisis, though. Hamlet's very sad. His sadness is also slight irritation because what has happened 2 months after his father died? His mom marries his uncle, his dad's brother, not 2 months after his dad died. So he's irritated at his uncle, but he doesn't really think that anything's going on. It's just a little bit strange that it happened so hastily. Then the crisis begins, and what happens in Hamlet that throws him into the crisis? He sees his father's ghost, and what does his father's ghost say? That's right. I have been foully and most unnaturally murdered by your brother, Laertes. Okay, now, this is a major epistemic crisis because think about what has happened to Hamlet in learning this news. What did he once believe about his role in society? Where did he stand in society? He's a prince, right? When his uncle dies, he's going to inherit the throne. Now, given this new news, what is his standing with regards to his uncle Laertes? What's that? He's a threat. He's a potential usurper, okay? A second problem that comes on the heels of that problem. If he is a threat, who can he trust? Can he trust his mom? Can he trust his uncle? Can he trust Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, who have been flown in from out of town by the king? Can he trust them? Can he trust Polonius, the advisor to the king, who seems to be a friend of his father's, but his father was murdered? Can he trust Polonius? Can he trust his girlfriend, Ophelia, daughter of Polonius? Can he trust any of these people? Can't trust any of these people, right? So here we are. The epistemic crisis is beginning to get very, very bad. So he does not know his role. He does not know who to trust. And he does not know how to act. Because if you know how to read Shakespeare, you see that he's got a handful of different kind of worldview possibilities that are open to him. One of them, most obviously, is that the Denmark that Shakespeare has created is at least quasi-Christian. So Hamlet's father has asked for revenge. Christianity forbids revenge. On the other hand, the Norse honor code, Denmark, demands revenge. If your dad is killed by his brother, no questions asked, kill the uncle, right? There's also like Machiavellian philosophy running around in Denmark at the time. Do whatever you have to do to stay in power is the bottom line for the Machiavellian. There are a couple of other choices out there for Hamlet, and so he doesn't know which one of these worldviews to apply to his present situation. Doesn't know who to trust, doesn't know how to act, doesn't know which worldview to apply, so Hamlet is basically stuck, right? Okay. Shakespeare wrote Hamlet in either 1600 or 1601, and the first time it was performed in London, René Descartes, the other guy I'm going to talk about, was probably 5 or 6 years old living in France. A lot of scholars think, and I'm not a scholar, but I agree with them, that Hamlet is Shakespeare's response to this massive epistemological crisis that is happening in Europe at the time. I think that's what kind of like prompted Shakespeare to write this play. Because everyone watching this is going to think of all of these things that have happened recently. The Copernican Revolution has taken place. The way that governments are organized is really changing. By the time Descartes comes around, even more things have changed. Oh, well, one other major factor for Shakespeare is the Catholics and the Protestants are at each other's throats. And it's not just that they hate each other, but they have a completely different way of justifying their claims to truth and authority, right? And with each successive king or queen that passes, you've got a different religious ruler that's coming into place. By the time Descartes comes around, you've also got the Latin Vulgate no longer being the primary language that is spoken in even the Catholic Church. Now the humanists are coming along and the reformers are coming along and they're doing translations from the original Greek and the original Hebrew, and there's some discrepancies between what the Latin Vulgate says and these new translations. And furthermore, reports are coming back from the New World, which we're standing in now, reports are coming back from the New World that unlike what Europe expected for this new world to be populated by wild, untamed savages, the new world was populated by, it seems like, a thriving civilization. This was not expected at all. So imagine all of these things are kind of swirling around in Europe at the time. You would feel, as an independent European, you're hearing these kind of things kind of trickle down. Your neighbor is telling you that the earth is no longer the center of the universe, that we're actually swinging around the sun. All of these things, the fighting between the Catholics and the Protestants, you're probably starting to wonder what in the world is going on. You're in the middle of a culture of a massive epistemic crisis. René Descartes is being trained as a theologian, and he's a mathematician, and he's right in the middle of this. And he is going to propose a way out, okay? So he's 32 years old, and he attends a conference in Paris. And at this conference in Paris, there's a philosopher, and the philosopher poses that, look, skepticism is knocking on the door. Everybody's really worried that we can't really know anything anymore. Let's just trust that we can make plausible cases that end in probability, and let's go with that as a workable epistemology. And apparently, Descartes hears this, and he gets mad. He's like, no, probability is not acceptable. What is acceptable is certainty. So the left side of the board that I do up here, certainty is what we've got to get after. And so I am going to get certainty. So how does he do this? He sits down in his chair and he says, I am going to start doubting until basically I hit a rock foundation and I can't doubt anymore. So I'm going to sit in my chair and I'm going to doubt whether or not my sense perceptions are accurate. I have found by experience, he says, that the senses sometimes deceive, and it is prudent never to trust completely those who have deceived us even once. He could be having a dream, he says. That could be an explanation for his sense perceptions. So then his methodological doubt grows more extreme. He imagines an imaginary demon of the utmost power and cunning, which is systematically deceiving him. This could be the case, he says. And everything that I once believed in the sky, the earth, all external things, that may be a trick. He soon is doubting whether or not he exists. Perhaps I do not exist. But here he stumbles upon something that he cannot doubt. He cannot doubt that he is thinking, because doubting requires thinking. And so if he's thinking, he's existing. Thus the famous phrase that he comes up with, I think, therefore I am. And upon this knowledge, he's going to build, upon this foundation, he's going to build his house of knowledge. So, Descartes thinks that he has found a way out of the epistemic crisis using radical doubt. And he's going to found his house on something indubitable, consciousness. But Descartes fails. Here are a few ways in which I think he fails. Now, I'm going to sound like everyone likes to pick on Descartes now, but he's a brilliant guy, brilliant philosopher, brilliant mathematician. And so I'm going to pick on him, but I don't want to deny the fact that he was a real genius. First way that Descartes fails is he fails to fulfill his own project. He says that he's going to doubt everything radically, but doesn't really. He's writing philosophy in the French language. And he's just taking for granted all of the concepts that he can portray in the French language. Furthermore, he's also writing in Latin. And he's also assuming that he can get across concepts that are the same in both French and in Latin. Furthermore, when you read him closely, you find out that a lot of the same phrases that he studied in his theological training show up verbatim in his kind of spontaneous imaginings while sitting in the couch. In fact, cogito ergo sum, I think therefore I am, is directly from St. Augustine, which was in his studies. So there are all these little phrases and words and sentences that he, wittingly or not, maybe even unwittingly, just brings into his philosophy of supposed radical doubt. So Descartes has mischaracterized his solution to the crisis. His solution, he says, is going to be radical doubt, but he's just kind of selective in the things that he doubts. It's pretty radical, but on certain things, like his ability to explain things with language, he doesn't doubt that. He thinks he can do that. So Hamlet is going to try to solve another epistemological crisis, and he's going to try to solve it in a different way. First, let's talk about what he's not going to do. Hamlet's doubts are not universal and radical. He doubts whether or not life is worth living, to be or not to be. Oh, that God's canons were not point against self-slaughter. So he wonders whether life is worth living, but he doesn't wonder if he is living. That would be right. That's too radical. He doesn't ask that question. He doesn't ask whether or not he can portray his thoughts to others with language. His doubts are severe, meaning they cause him to wonder who he can trust, how he should act, but they're not radical in the way that Descartes are. He does not doubt whether he was born in Denmark. He does not doubt whether Gertrude was his mother, Laertes, his uncle, whether his father was his father. He does not doubt whether Elsinore is the castle that he's living in. He does not doubt any of those things. So his doubts are very specific. He will attempt to solve the epistemological crisis in the same way that I solved my Kiva crisis, by posing an alternative narrative of events to the one that he originally believed, and seeing if that alternative narrative of events works. So at Kiva, I try to give a coherent, intelligible account of the totality of the known truths. I did not recognize this woman. She did not know me. I did not know Pandra. We were both in the Kiva grocery store. I had cardboard boxes under my arms, etc., etc., etc. So my narrative tried to account for all of those known facts. My narrative also explained why this woman was confused, why she thought that I was someone that I was not, why she thought that I was a Kiva employee. It accounted for that because, oh, I've got these boxes under my arms. My narrative takes account of that. My narrative shows how I might test the problem that I'm encountering. And the way that I tested it is to say, I don't work at Kiva. Oh, and that was the solution. She says, oh, yeah, you don't work at Kiva. Okay, I'm going to go find somebody else who does work at Kiva. So my narrative account gave a way for me to test whether or not my narrative account seemed to be passing muster. Hamlet does the same thing. He has an old narrative. My father died of natural causes. Now this new narrative comes along and he has to try it out. Does it take account of all of the facts at his disposal? Does this new narrative that my uncle has murdered my father and married my mother, is that narrative that I now believe, does it account for all the facts? And it does seem to account for all the facts, especially the one that was kind of bugging him, namely, why did they get married so fast? Why did they get married 2 months after Dad's death? That was kind of bugging him before. This new narrative better accounts for that strange event better than his old narrative did. Does that make sense by tracking this? And his narrative provides a way to test his narrative, to show how to proceed out of his crisis. And so what does Hamlet do to try to test his new narrative? Because he's even got some doubts about this. He's got a ghost talking to him. He's wondering if he's completely sane. So how does he test this new narrative? So there's this traveling troupe of actors. Actors are good for something. They come into the castle, and Hamlet sets it all up. He's like, listen, I want you to play out this little scene. And the scene is a guy killing another guy in the garden by pouring poison in his ear, because that's how he thinks his uncle killed his father. So he puts that on stage, and Hamlet is watching Laertes and Gertrude, and based on their reactions, he's going to find out if for sure they did it, and their reaction is, in philosophical language, they freaked out. They totally freaked out, and Hamlet's like, gotcha, right? So his narrative gave an account of the way that he could test his narrative to see if it actually worked. Okay. So I think that Hamlet succeeds because he poses a narrative account, and I think that part of the reason that Descartes fails is Descartes does not give a narrative account. He doesn't ever talk about the crisis at hand and how the crisis at hand created this massive question of how we can know what we know. Hamlet doesn't have radical doubts either. His doubts are reasoned doubts based on the gaps, based on the misunderstandings. So, that's the end of my talk. I think part of the reason I think that narrative is so important is will become more clear when you do the Thomas Kuhn discussion tomorrow. So ask yourself, if Thomas Kuhn is giving a narrative account of these different revolutions in science, or whether or not he's doing sort of a Cartesian account, meaning like a radical doubt of all of these different things that have come before in science. Ask yourself that question. Okay, the end. Anybody have any? Now's question and answer time. And is it just, I think it's just me for questions and answers.
So I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I'm wondering where your thinking is going in relating narrative as a pragmatic tool. I mean, I'm constructing narrative to try to understand my situation as what you described there. How would you relate that to narrative as an art? That is, the person who writes narratives, you know, the novelist, the playwright. Do you see a corollary between them? Are they accomplishing? Is there a similar goal there, or is that an entirely different thing? How would you?
They're not entirely different things. I've been thinking about this, and I'm going to talk out loud for a second. It seems like for someone writing literature, coherence is integrity. And what I mean by that is this. If Hamlet, having discovered that his uncle had killed his father, if Hamlet said, oh, you know, that's okay, don't worry about it, based on what we've seen from Hamlet's character up into this point of the, you know, like the middle point of the plot, then we'd say that Shakespeare's lying. Not only is he lying with regards to the internal coherence of the narrative of the play Hamlet, but he's also lying about the external things that he has brought into the play, namely the characters of human beings. And when father's sons are murdered by their uncle, it's unlikely, extremely unlikely, based on what we've experienced in our life, that he would say, shucks, don't worry about it. It's no big deal. So I think narrative is this way of providing coherence to one's life, not just the events at Kiva, but the overall sense of, does my life have a purpose? Am I going somewhere? Where did I come from? It provides a cohesiveness to our life that makes our actions hopefully sensible to us, sensible to other people. And it also does the same thing in fictional narrative accounts. It provides a cohesive account of the way that the world is, about why my characters would act in this way. There's a lot more to it than that, but that's the best I've got so far.
So it sounds like you're saying how this relates to Sayers, what Sayers is saying. I understood Sayers to be saying that what the poet was doing, that both the poet and the scientist do creative imagining, and they're essentially using the same process of observing things, creating likenesses, merging them into a unique unity that has...
Both the scientist and the poet?
Are both okay. Doing that. And the difference in this unity can be used as a tool, as if it is an actual object. And the difference between them is the things that a science is looking at are quantifiable. The things that a poet is looking at are its qualitative likenesses that he's looking at. So both in their own way, they are creating narratives, but they're narratives about different things, quantifiable things or qualitative things. And so you're just saying in the same way, that's just what we all do to problem solve, to try to understand, to make sense of things, whatever it is we're making sense of things. And that's what Hamlet was doing to make sense of how do I understand, what happened to my dad, and what do I do about it? And Descartes was trying to make sense of a bigger epistemic crisis, trying to work himself back to first principles or even before that, if possible, to establish everything on a firm foundation. So he's doubting everything, all the narratives that he's heard before, and taking all the pieces and trying to assemble various narratives and determine which is the superior narrative. So is that basically what you're saying?
That is it. The only thing that I'm not sure, I think that Sayers thinks that poets do something a little bit different than scientists, and that scientists look and quantify, yes. But poets and artists try to put two things together that have not been together before, try to put them together imaginatively to kind of show new relationships. So in that way, they are doing slightly different things.
But well, it's the difference is qualitative versus quantitative.
Yeah.
Similarities based on quantity, similarities based on quality. But it's similarities we're looking at, just different types of similarities. The scientist looks at similarities of quantity. The poet looks at similarities. So I think that's the same thing you're saying about the poet is putting things together that haven't been put together before, but it's put together based on quality. There's probably more things you can put together based on quality than you can put together based on quantity.
Mm-hmm. And they have different goals. The scientists have a really different goal than what Shakespeare had.
Not to understand. I mean, it's just in general to understand, to get an accurate picture of the way, what reality is.
That's probably not Shakespeare's only goal, whereas I think a scientist would probably say that's the primary goal. And, well, maybe Shakespeare would say that's his primary goal. I don't know. I have to think about that. Maybe they are doing the same thing.